Hi, and welcome back to the show. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. Today's special guest is Ben McGarry, founder and portfolio manager of Totus Capital. Totus was recently the winner of the Hedge Fund's Rock Award for the Best Market Neutral Fund Manager, and they put in a pretty impressive set of performance figures over the last 7 years since they launched. Ben's a pretty interesting and unique investor. He started his career as an accountant, before getting experience on both the buy and the sell sides, and eventually, of course, founding Totus Capital. He's an expert on short selling, so hopefully we can gain some insights into the benefits this can bring both at a market and a portfolio level. Today, we're going to discuss some of the common accounting tricks that companies use to mask their true performance. We'll discuss his short thesis on a very well-known company, and we'll investigate why it took a public short report from an overseas short seller in order to bring down Quintus. Before we get into that though, I've got a bit of a favour to ask. iTunes rankings make a huge impact on the visibility of the show, and as a result, the calibre of the guests that I can bring to you. It only takes a few seconds to jump in and click that subscribe button, but it benefits both of us. If you're not already a subscriber, please head on over and hit that button. If you feel like leaving us a rating or a review while you're there, all the better. And to those who have already subscribed, thanks very much. Well, that's it from me for now. Let's get into the interview. I hope you enjoy the show. Good afternoon, Ben. It's great to have you on the show.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
I noticed when I was looking at your LinkedIn profile just before that there was a bit of a gap between when you finished school and starting at Morgan Stanley. I'm curious, what did you get up to in that time? Were you working in another industry or traveling?
Patrick, I started out in Brisbane. I'm a Brisbane boy. I went to the University of Queensland. Wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, and knew I was interested in numbers and finance, and got a job with PricewaterhouseCoopers after finishing a commerce and economics degree in Brisbane, thinking that would be a good way to learn more about companies. I'd been a keen amateur investor at university. So that was, I suppose, the little gap between school and Morgan Stanley was uni and PricewaterhouseCoopers.
So I'm guessing the accounting skills that you would have learnt there would have been pretty useful for you in your later career. What have been some of the major influences on your investment philosophy as it stands today?
Yeah, Patrick, you're right. I think that accounting background was really good training. I started out as an industrials analyst covering building materials and construction companies in Europe. Accounting was a good way to see how financial statements were put together, how real businesses operated, but it was a poor place for a keen investor to spend their career due to conflicts around what you can and can't invest in as a working for a big chartered accounting firm. So it was a great place to get some good bottom-up knowledge on companies and how financials work. But once I qualified as a chartered accountant, I moved on and into the sell side of the investment banking world.
So was that where you picked up your interest in short selling?
I think the interest in short selling really came from just looking at our industry, which is highly cyclical, and thinking about a way to, I suppose, bring up a family, have a career that wasn't interrupted by large gaps when the market wasn't going in your favour, and finding a way to protect capital regardless of what's going on in the overall market or the economy. So the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009 was obviously a key influence, and realizing, the ability to recognize low quality companies with that are facing challenges and benefit from or protecting your portfolio with short positions in some of those companies was extremely valuable. and the value of a dollar, you know, that was saved through the financial crisis was multiplied when you were able to put it to work, you know, in good companies at reasonable prices post, you know, a market dislocation like that. So the short selling was, you know, a combination of, you know, I suppose career preservation and capital preservation, and a good way to, you know, use the knowledge, because we meet hundreds and hundreds of companies each year, and hardly any of them are worthy of an investment, and a number of them are quite good shorts. So being able to utilize that knowledge as well.
So we've heard a little bit about your past. Let's fast forward a little bit. You'd spent some time working, you know, initially on the sell side and then on the buy side as well. But it was quite early on in your career that you went out and founded TOTUS. I'm curious, what was it like going and starting a firm, you know, relatively early in your career? What were some of the challenges that you faced that you didn't expect?
I think, you know, they say ignorance is bliss, and I think I was certainly helped by a good dose of ignorance in starting out with TOTUS. I think, you know, if I had to do it again these days as a you know, on a really skinny capital base with the extra compliance and you know, regulatory costs that are prevalent in the industry these days, I'm not sure I would have done it. You know, had I known all of those things, but look, I think, you know, I had the right mindset, which was that it was going to take time, and that I had a process that I believed in and knew could protect and compound capital at decent rates. And if I was able to keep, you know, at my costs low, and let enough time pass that the numbers started to demonstrate, you know, that we knew what we were doing, that we would be able to find some like-minded investors. And you know, the objective was to hopefully one day have enough of those to earn a living. And we, you know, we've been lucky that you know, it panned out that way.
Yeah, you've certainly had some pretty impressive success over the last few years, but I'm sure you've also experienced some challenges along the way. I know a lot of the long-only managers that we talk to, they often talk about how they've learned and improved over the years. Do you experience the same thing with short selling?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, they say you don't want to get in a race car with somebody that hasn't, you know, had an accident, and I think a little bit of scar tissue is important for any fund manager. You know, we're lucky that we've only had one down year in you know, the almost seven since we launched, but we did learn some, you know, valuable lessons from that down year in 2016. One of the key things was to think about you know, how well understood and positioning in a company or a sector that you're short, you really need to understand whether the market is new to that idea, very comfortable with that idea, or if the idea is quite mature and crowded. And the more mature and crowded a theme or a short becomes, the riskier it is. So you need to manage your position size, and you need to think about potentially being hedged, you know, in very mature themes. So that was one thing we did poorly in 2016. We had been short the resources sector for 4 years and done very well out of it. We stayed too long. By the time, you know, we got to early 2016, the positioning in that theme and those stocks was very crowded on the short side. So it didn't take too much good news to get it moving the other way. So these days, in a theme that we really like, or we are short, once the market is well onto it, we make sure that position size is reducing, and or that we've got some hedges within that sector or industry to mitigate, you know, the damage if the theme comes to an end or turns.
Are there any sectors or short themes out there at the moment that you're seeing that are having that same kind of crowding in the short thesis?
In the short thesis, look, I suppose we saw it a little bit in the retail sector through August. I think people have been, you know, aware that a housing downturn is going to have a potentially material impact on discretionary retailers. We haven't seen that come through in the earnings results for those companies just yet. And we saw some pretty sharp moves off early in August through the reporting season in heavily shorted retail stocks. So that was probably one where positioning got a little crowded ahead of the fundamentals. On the long side, I think the area that where there's clear sort of a mature theme is tech. We still think that there's some value in the mega cap part of the tech market, but there's certainly some very, very expensive tech stocks here in Australia and in that mid-cap space. So I think that there's, you know, a fair bit of risk to the downside on those names, where I think people have got to the theme very late and are not being careful enough about the prices they're paying for companies.
Yeah, it seems a lot of the long-only side of the market has been a bit concerned about that same area in the tech there. There's certainly some very stretched looking multiples there. But let's talk a little bit about some recent kind of high profile blow-ups. With both Blue Sky and Quintus, the short thesis, or short theses I should say, had been pretty well established within the Australian market for quite some time, particularly with Quintus. I mean, I've been hearing about short theses on that stock for many years before Glaucus came in. So why do you think it took the overseas short sellers coming in with that high profile report to bring those stocks down when the Aussie short sellers had already been negative on these stocks for such a long time?
Yeah, I think the key difference between investing on the long side and looking for shorts to hedge your portfolio is that a short needs a catalyst to play out. Expensive stocks can stay expensive for a long time. You know, fad stocks, frauds and failures can go on for a long time. And a company that doesn't earn any money, that has no real prospects of success over the long term, that's trading at $1 billion one day, can trade at a $2 billion valuation a week later with no change in the fundamentals. So what it really needs is somebody to shine a light on the problems or the inconsistencies with the story. And that's very difficult for Australian investors to do given our defamation and libel laws. So I suppose it opened that opportunity for US-based funds who are protected by the First Amendment to ask some serious questions about these companies without fear of legal reprisal. And that was, once you know you ask the right questions, it opens up other questions, which if the company does have problems, they're going to struggle to answer. And I think that's what we saw with the Glaucus reports on Quintus and Blue Sky, that they shone a light and got people asking the right questions.
Do you think we do need more protection for Australian short sellers and investors so that they can go out and ask those questions publicly?
Well, I think, there doesn't seem to be legal reprisal against people that are promoting the long thesis on companies. And I think one thing that the shorts can do is highlight problematic business models. And the longer that these business models go on constantly raising money from the market, mum and dad investors, the more people that can get sucked into these stories, and the more people that when they finally deflate can end up losing money. And it can be, you know, life-changing for some people. And I think that, you know, the short sellers in occasionally have highlighted, you know, real issues and potentially stopped these bubbles getting bigger than they should have and more people losing money. So I think there's a place for it. And the one thing that you can be certain of is that if you go out with a short thesis on a company that is legitimate and has a strong business and management is executing, you are going to lose money. So you really have to be very certain about your thesis to go out publicly on a short position, and that's worth taking notice of.
Well, let's talk about a practical example. I'd like to hear about the first time you shorted a company. What was the company and what were some of the problems you saw in that business? And of course, how did it turn out?
Well, I'd come from a long only background in investing, but had been lucky enough to cover a few companies that had problematic business models. ABC Learning was the first one, but when I was at UBS, I covered Alesco and Trans-Pacific, which were both very, all three of those companies were very acquisitive, used lots of equity issuance to fund it, but also some debt. And when the markets closed during the financial crisis, they ran into trouble. That was all well and good to have, you know, a written thesis, but it wasn't real money at work. When I was in the process of setting up TOTUS, one of the exercises I did was to open a CFD account and put some real money to work on short ideas, and the most successful of those was a short investment in Guns, which was a company I'd covered both on the buy and sell side and had followed for a number of years. And the thing that was really interesting about Guns is that it was the was that many of the other companies in its industry were facing difficulties or had gone bust. And when you looked at, you know, there were a number of factors that were really going against that company, but the key one was the currency. So I shorted some Guns in that CFD account, and it basically paid for the legal cost to set up TOTUS Capital, which was, you know, a vote of confidence, at least for me, that I was on the right track with the research.
Certainly sounds that way. Well, you talked before about frauds and fads, but I know that there's a broader classification system that a lot of short sellers like to use to talk about the different types of potential shorts. I was wondering if you could talk us through some of those different types and, you know, what are the, just broadly at a high level, what are the indicators there?
There's almost a million different, you know, reasons that a company could become a short for a period of time. It might be, you know, a cyclical downturn. It might be a structural change, like in an industry where new competitors are coming in and have changed the business model. It might be something as simple as a management change or a degradation in the quality of the accounts that the company is presenting, the use of accounting tricks which might indicate that the company is struggling to maintain growth rates, and a market multiple. So it's difficult. You know, the traditional bucket is fads, frauds and failures. There's macro shorts, which might be that if a certain event happens in the economy, a certain group of companies will likely struggle in that event. Those ones we tend to find are difficult. I suppose there's regulatory driven shorts where you're hoping that a change in government or the act of a regulator will impact a business model. We think that those are extremely difficult shorts to play out, and we saw that play out with Bill Ackman at Pershing Square with Herbalife, so we try to avoid those kind of companies. So what we're really looking for is the best ones that we find are where the numbers are telling us a totally different story to what the market has bought into. So we're seeing evidence that the business is under stress. We've identified a clear catalyst for the market to start focusing in on that. And where the shorts have worked spectacularly well is where those companies have been reliant on external capital to fund their growth. So those are the key sort of attributes that we're looking for in our shorts.
You mentioned just before accounting tricks. I was wondering if you could tell us what are some of the indicators you're looking for when you're assessing a set of financial statements that they might be using some of these accounting tricks.
Okay. There's some really basic research you can do that might indicate, you know, that a company is being more aggressive in the way that they present their numbers to the market. And, you know, one of the simplest things is to look at the difference between, you know, adjusted or normalized earnings and the company's reported earnings. And the larger the gap is, the companies tend to normalize things that go in their favor. So they take out bad news and try to present earnings that look better than what the accounting standards would allow them to present, which is their reported earnings. That's a basic one. The key thing that we look for is that cash flow is reflecting what we're seeing in the profit and loss statement, so that the company is generating cash that's commensurate with what they're showing in the profit and loss statement. The other thing that we look for is aggressive capitalization of costs, so putting costs through the balance sheet that should have gone through the profit and loss statement, which inflates the profit that a company is showing to the market. And it, one of the things that we've seen of late is companies acquiring customers and running those acquisition costs through the balance sheet, which are really customer acquisition costs, which should go through the profit and loss statement. So there's a few sort of high level things you can look out for: aggressive capitalization of costs, divergence between cash flow and operating profit or EBITDA, for example.
Do you find that throughout the cycle, the amount of accounting tricks that you're seeing across the market is fluctuating? Is it a cyclical thing, or does it kind of stay the same or move randomly?
Our feeling is that you tend to see more bad behavior or lower quality accounts late in the cycle, and that is probably because share prices, it's more difficult for management to maintain share prices. They're trying to show a maintenance of growth rate by using levers to inflate earnings, which they wouldn't have had to do earlier in the cycle. One of the big things that we've seen companies do is move, costs from the profit and loss to the balance sheet. And it was actually unusual not to see it in in the last set of results that came through in August. So, it was very rare that you saw an improvement in earnings quality during August. The general trend was for companies to normalize, to capitalize, and to get investors to focus on non-traditional financial metrics, which is the time that you should be focusing on traditional financial metrics.
So it's safe to say then that we're seeing an elevated level of these kinds of things at the moment?
I think so. I mean, you've got examples of companies having to change adjust their earnings because of changes in accounting standards, and then just using other financial levers to correct those adjustments. So, I think we're definitely seeing a fair bit more of that. So it's another signpost, to say that we're a little late in this, bull market, and that people should be holding some cash or looking for ways to hedge long exposures.
Yeah, definitely hearing more and more of that kind of attitude out there at the moment. Let's talk through a current example. I know quite a number of your shorts you do actually disclose. So I'm curious, out of the ones where you're already public on your shorts, which do you think is the most controversial of them?
Look, it's difficult. I mean, I think that, the really, I can't say that any of the shorts that we've disclosed publicly in the ASX are in that fads, frauds and failures bucket. So I think the ones that have played out that we mentioned earlier in this podcast were probably the most obvious ones, the ones that the Glaucus reports identified. The one that is really topical and that looks extremely interesting to us these days is Tesla, and it has been a graveyard for short sellers. But the behavior of the company and the management is very, very reminiscent of companies that we've seen get into serious trouble in the past. They're hugely reliant on external capital to fund their growth. There is a large and growing gap between the forecasts and expectations that they put out to the market and what is actually delivered you know, there is a large short interest, which is, I suppose, the biggest, you know, positive for the stock. But I think Tesla, you know, is finally, you know, looking like it's got all the ingredients to be, you know, a spectacular short. Now, that doesn't mean it won't, you know, it couldn't go up 20, 30 or 40% from here before it goes down a long way. But I do think that looks extremely interesting to us as a prospective short.
Yeah, it seems to have come off a little bit over the last few months, or at least had its long and steep appreciation consolidate somewhat. I'm wondering if you could talk us through some of the recent developments that have been happening there. It's been quite fascinating to watch it all play out on social media, but I know, you know, not all of our listeners would have been following the events that are going on there. So could you tell us about some of the things that have changed in the Tesla situation in the last few, say, months?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that have changed. I mean, the company has not made new highs despite, or the share price has not made new highs despite things like privatization proposals for close to 18 months now. There has been a steady stream of promotional announcements from the company, which has are failing to boost the share price like they used to. I think there is the key to the company's future is the success of the Model 3, and the jury is out as to, you know, as to whether or not that will be a success or a failure. There's been some well documented issues with manufacturing. They've gone to using a tent in the car park of the Fremont factory to manufacture cars. That issue is sort of now faded, and it's become a delivery issue. So it's sort of almost a day-to-day proposition as to what the, you know, the later, you know, each piece of news looks a little worse than the last. But I think when you piece them all together, it shows a picture of a company that is really running low on cash. You've got a management team that is under legal and financial pressure that is making what decisions that to us don't look to be in the best long-term interests of shareholders. So yeah, I think we're coming close to a point, if they don't raise capital very soon, where, you know, things could get really interesting at Tesla.
Do you think if they needed to raise equity capital today that they'd be able to?
That is the biggest mystery. With a company with a $50 billion market cap and $10 billion of debt, you know, a 20% share issue should, you know, kick the can down the road a long way. So the question that we've been asking ourselves, and the reason why the short is not, you know, as big as it could be, is, you know, why haven't they raised that money? And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, there is all sorts of conspiracy theories on Twitter, and there's bloggers, and there's legal experts in the US who have, you know, more well thought out theories on why that is. But, you know, I think that given what looks like a severe cash crunch at Tesla, the fact that they haven't raised capital is very telling. And the most logical answer is that these investigations from the SEC and the Department of Justice are somehow inhibiting their ability to raise capital, which is very bad if that's the case.
Yeah, certainly not a good situation for the Tesla longs if that is the case.
Yeah, one of the things, Patrick, we look at is the strength of the opposing argument, and we've looked hard at the long thesis for Tesla, and the three things that, you know, it seems to come down to are that, you know, Elon Musk is a genius, and we've read the book, and he's certainly a very impressive, you know, person. The other thing that people talk about is, you know, how good the cars are to drive. And that, you know, in the long term, you know, he's a disruptor, and it's going to be good for the planet. But none of those things sort of pay the $10 billion worth of debt back, and we think that they've got, in the long run, very little bearing on, you know, the financial outcome for shareholders. So we think that the, you know, the concerns that are obvious around Tesla far outweigh those sort of positive points backing the man or the quality of the product.
One of the interesting things I think that was pointed out to me by another manager who's long only but not long this particular stock is that while people tend to compare it to, you know, Google and Facebook and a lot of the other tech stocks, it doesn't benefit from the same scalability that a lot of the other tech stocks do, which I think is an interesting comparison to make.
Yeah, I think the key difference is that between Tesla and Amazon or those other names you mentioned is that Tesla is reliant on external capital and equity markets to fund its growth. Apple, Alphabet, Amazon have not raised equity capital for many, many years. They do occasionally use debt markets, but they are highly cash generative businesses. Tesla has only reported a quarterly operating profit once in its 15 years as a listed entity. So that is the key difference to us. It's the ability to fund their own growth. So Tesla is lumped in the tech bucket, which for us is interesting. We do have some investments in some of those other mega cap tech names, and we think Tesla fits there nicely as a hedge against those cash generative longs.
Well, let's take some of the things that we've discussed and just kind of bring it all back to summarize the discussion. So in a list, what are some of the attributes that you look for when you're putting together a potential short thesis?
Okay, so the things that we would look at are a valuation or a business model issue that would cause that provides some downside to the current share price. We would need a catalyst for the market to focus in on that issue. We would monitor things like the cost of borrow and the percentage of short interest to gauge the risk around the position, and the liquidity in the stock is another thing that we would monitor closely, because if you're short a stock and there's and it's not that liquid and there's not that much borrow around and your stock gets recalled, you're going to have to buy that in the market at whatever price that stock is trading at, and that can get very expensive. So there's a number of factors. The more factors that we see lining up that are negative, whether it's aggressive accounting, a structurally challenged business model, insider selling, a negative catalyst that is coming up, or a positive catalyst that has just been the liquidity in the stock, the more of those that we see line up, the more comfortable we are with a larger short position. But we never take a short position larger than 5% in the fund. It's looking at a mosaic of those factors, that gives us the comfort to go short. And the more of those that we see, the bigger the short can get.
Well, look, that concludes the main part of the interview, but I've got a few regular questions that I like to go over with every guest. So if you'd like to stick around for a second, we can go through those. They're a bit of fun.
Okay. Sounds good, Patrick.
Excellent. All right. So first of all, could you share with us something that you've read recently, either a book or an article or a piece of research that really impressed you?
Look, with the sell-off in the Chinese internet names, we have gone back and looked at some of the bull theses on the Chinese economy and the Chinese leading internet names. I'm thinking about the likes of Tencent, Baidu, and JD.com. And I think when stocks and markets are down 30 to 50% in a short period, it's worth going back and looking at why people were interested in owning those things in the first place. And this week we've looked at an investment blog by a fund called Saber Capital Management out of the US that has some extremely sensible things to say about Tencent and the strength of their business in the US. So, I think it's always worth looking, at situations where the baby is getting thrown out with the bathwater at, the opposing case, and remembering that there is an elastic band effect in markets, and they do tend to overshoot on both the upside and the downside. So I'd recommend that blog to keen investors.
Excellent. Well, I'll get a link from you after the show, and I'll add it to The Wire. So to the audience, if you just jump on the LiveWire website for The Wire of this podcast, you should be able to find a link to that blog post. Let's take a trip back in time for a second. If you could go back to when you were finishing uni or school and give yourself just one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
It's hard to go past, you know, the advantage of time and taking some long-term thinking. I mean, Bezos talks about the advantages that you have over people if most people find it difficult to take life decisions that or to look further than 3 or 4 years ahead. But if you can take your decision-making process out to a 7 to 10 year process, you're going to be far, far better off and going to be able to achieve much greater things than if you're looking at, you know, on shorter term timeframes. So I think things like, you know, with investing, the getting started early, it's never too late, but time is your best friend. Avoiding, you know, don't worry about the fear of missing out. Sticking to cash generative, boring companies in the long run is going to get you far further than trying to be in the spiciest or the fastest or the best performing stock in any one particular year. So I think it's slow and steady wins the race, and the most important thing is starting the race.
Definitely. That sounds like solid advice. Now, before we get into this last question, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting that anybody go out there and put all of their money into a single stock and forget about it for 5 years. This is supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking. With that being said, if the market was going to close for 5 years starting from tomorrow and you could only own shares in one company, what would it be?
Look, I think a safe one that you could put in that bucket is something like Berkshire Hathaway, which has been a holding in our portfolio for 3 or 4 years now. It is a collection of highly cash generative, strong businesses with long track records and sustainable business moats put together by two of the greatest investors of all time. And whilst they are certainly getting on in years, and there is likely to be some volatility, you know, if and when Warren and Charlie do eventually pass on, I think that would be a buying opportunity in that company. And that if you were to look at Berkshire as a potential breakup play, you know, there is an argument that the sum of the parts is worth more than the current share price. And we also, it's like buying the cash generating parts of the S&P 500 in a very tax effective structure that is, you know, is a beautiful way to allocate capital to the best performing parts of the portfolio without having to sell businesses and pay tax all the way through as you would in a diversified share portfolio. So Berkshire's probably the safe one.
Definitely, doesn't get much safer than that. Well, that's it for this week's episode, Ben. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Patrick.
Well, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. The next guest for the Rules of Investing will be Alex Milton, who's the Principal and Co-Portfolio Manager at Novaport Capital. We'll be discussing some Aussie small caps and the recent correction in momentum stocks. It was recorded the morning that the NASDAQ fell 4.4%, so I hope you find it as interesting and informative as I did. In the meantime, please subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at LiveWire Markets, and visit our website, livewiremarkets.com. And as always, thanks for listening.